copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So this section I've entitled Healing and Hope, and here I want to take you into some of the secular ideas, the research that has come out of two particular people. John Gottman is one of them, and he's written some very well-known books, Why Marriages Succeed or Fail, much more recent book, The Science of Trust. And then Sue Johnson, a book from Christians on for pastors particularly and for counselors, Counseling Couples in Conflict by James Sells and Mark Yarhouse is a very useful book. And I'll come back to Sue Johnson at the end. What the Gottmans did in their research, which has been going on for many years now, was basically ask the question, what makes marriages succeed or fail? And what makes love last? Now, they weren't distinguishing between Christians and non-Christians here, but they took couples and they put them in a three-hour assessment where they videotaped them in discussions. They measured their heart rate, their blood pressure. They watched their facial expressions, etc. And they found that they could predict with 90% accuracy after just a very short time of watching them on video, something like 5 or 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, they could predict with 90% accuracy who would break up, which marriages would fail, and who would stay together. And this is across cultures. Okay, now there are lots of differences in marriage in different cultures, but they've done this in a number of cultures. And one of the things they say is that conflict in marriage is not a bad thing. You're two individual people. You have a right to have differences, but how you deal with your difference is the critical thing, of course. Now, they divide people up. They categorize them as masters and disasters. Okay, and so that the quality, we look at the qualities of each. So, and remember that slide on love in 1 Corinthians 13. The masters in marriage who do a good job are gentle and kind. They admit mistakes. They take responsibility. They build appreciation and respect. They show gratitude. They listen well. They have humor and affection. And they know how to soothe themselves and to soothe their partner. That's a pretty good parallel, isn't it, with 1 Corinthians 13 there. Now, the masters, therefore, are very gentle with each other in disagreements. They know how to have what they call soft startups. Rather than just getting furious with your spouse immediately and yelling at them, you gently approach a difference, especially women learning to have soft startups. They have frequent thoughts, positive thoughts about the positive aspects of their spouse and minimize their focus on the negative aspects. Now, when a marriage begins to go downhill, you see that usually spinning the other way. All you can think about is the negative things about this person. So there's a certain discipline in making yourself remember the positives when things are difficult. Masters avoid contempt, and that's a critical one we'll come back to. They know how to soothe and change the subject to distract from some of the painful things in a kind and gentle way. Now, it's been found that men tend to, when there is conflict, tend to be more physiologically aroused. Their heart goes up faster, their blood pressure goes up faster, and men tend, therefore, to, probably because they're tempted more to fight physically, react that way, they're built more for that, they tend to either fight or flee, or they freeze, which is, of course, the escape mechanism. I don't know what to do here, I'm a deer caught in the headlights, so none of those reactions are particularly helpful. in a relationship. But the physiological arousal makes that more likely to happen with men. So when you get to the disasters, they are the four things that he calls, there are four things that stand out: criticism, defensiveness and blaming, contempt, and stonewalling, as he calls it, which is the withdrawing. And they call this the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Okay? And once these four horsemen enter a marriage, then there's a real danger that you're beginning to go downhill. Now, most good marriages have times of where the four horsemen invade your household for a while, and part of the task is to push them out again or get a therapist or a counselor or a pastor to help you do that. So looking at each of these in a bit more detail, with criticism and defensiveness and blaming first, the pattern of escalation of conflict into these four horsemen predicted, if this was a pattern that they saw in these recorded interviews, predicted divorce 5.5 years after marriage. Now, we know that the 5 to 8 year window is a pretty tense one. They're often young children, you know, you've got over the initial phases of marriage, and now that is a typically difficult time. And the couples who are going downhill into this, these tend, as I said, to interpret everything negatively. They ignore the positive. So criticism is attacking someone's personality or character rather than talking about a specific behavior, usually with blame. Criticism usually comes with a harsh startup. Now, airing a complaint or a difference or a desire is obviously, if it's done properly, it's a good thing. Pete Scazzaro, a pastor in New York City, I was hearing him speak just the other day, and he trains his whole church in communication skills of how not to be contemptuous and critical. He doesn't just do it with couples. The whole church goes through these exercises. And one of the exercises is when you have a difference with someone, you say, I have noticed that this is what you do every time I try to talk to you about this problem. You know, I would really prefer it if you would stop and look me in the eye and that we could have a proper conversation. So it's the language of, I've noticed, I would prefer, which is not an attacking. It is a complaint in a sense, but it's not an attack. It's not contemptuous. It's a more constructive way, and I think couples need that help. Gottman says that the first 3 minutes of a conflict, when they're watching a conflict on video, predict what the relationship will be like 5 years later. That's the pattern that they're in. So the defensiveness, of course, is you both feel that the other person is blaming you. It's always my fault. She never says sorry. She always makes me feel it's my fault. And of course, she feels exactly the same. You meet criticism with criticism. You make excuses. People repeat themselves. And I think especially, as I said earlier, for if people are ashamed, we feel other people attacking us, we tend to want to shame them back to get revenge. It's a gut response, reflex, when we're shamed. And taking responsibility, it defuses a fight, doesn't it? I'm really sorry, I didn't mean to hurt you in this way, and I'm so sorry that I did, and I take responsibility for doing that. Please will you forgive me, and to be able to name the harm and the damage that you have done, and usually then that opens the door for the other person to take responsibility for themselves. And I think the Gottmans noticed that women often are more reluctant than men to take responsibility first. The men often feel more targeted as the cause of the problems. Now, contempt is the sort of next layer, isn't it, from criticism. Contempt is where you have the intention to insult and psychologically abuse. You act from a superior attitude. You insult, you call names, you mock, you use hostile humor. Your body language is sneering. How could you do that to me? That is disgusting. You are always so late when we want to go out anywhere. You always. Those are contempt, aren't they? Contempt is a very onomatopoeic word. It carries the disgust in its the way you say it. Contempt. You want to spit about this person. And when people live in the shadow of a contemptuous other person, they get sick more. There's more illness. Their immune system is undermined. And contempt involves criticism of character rather than actions. You're always lazy. You're such an idiot. You're crazy. You're stupid. And the disasters tend to be scanning for mistakes. They're looking for mistakes, noticing those. They're irritable and annoyed all the time. The masters are scanning for what is right. What what is good, and they express appreciation. Now, in our culture, we tend to think that we tend to train people to be critical thinkers, don't we? There's something about critical thinking that is valued, to be discerning and critical. If you're an educated person, you're critical and cynical about life. It's dangerous if you take that over into your marriage. Then the last one, withdrawal and stonewalling, is here, and you're trying to be neutral and not make things worse, or you escape from the tension. So you might have good intentions. I don't want to inflame this, or it might be a means of passive aggression. You know, I'm not going to talk to you about this. And you get back at the other person by refusing to engage. Men often tend to retreat, as I said earlier, into their cave, and women tend to pursue them, trying to draw them out. That may not be a good idea for women to do that, because then he's cornered in his cave, and he may come out like a bear, fighting. So it's sort of like men say, I always make it worse if I open my mouth, so I'm going to wait for the storm to blow over and die down. Now, that may be a good idea. I mean, obviously, when you're in fights, we have to teach folk who are in marriage conflict to take time out. When your pulse rate goes above 100, stop. When you start saying contemptuous words or thinking contemptuous thoughts, stop. Take a break. Come back to this in half an hour later on in the evening if this is something you really need to talk about. I often say to couples, I don't want you to talk about these difficult things except in this room with me when it's really inflammatory. And then you're teaching them the art of better communication. And then, so the stonewalling, those are the four there. Now, John Gottman says there is this magic ratio that in a marriage, and I think it applies to all relationships, that you need, for every one negative comment, you need at least five positives. And once a marriage is going downhill, the ratio begins to descend to 4-1, 3-1, 2-1, 1-1, and then it's all negative. So once it goes below 5-1, the chances of it breaking up are bad. Then they talk a lot about the importance of nurturing friendship and intimacy. And this means you need to get to know your partner's world. You need to have a curiosity. That wonderful sort of enchantment that you had when you were falling in love and engaged and you wanted to sit and talk for hours and find out about each other. Once you're married and you have little children or even bigger children, you tend not to do that. You assume you know. My wife and I make it a point of sort of spiritual discipline to, at the end of the day when we meet after work, to ask each other about how was the day for you. And it may be very dull and boring. Well, okay, that's okay, let's hear about that. It may be very exciting, something that's happened, but to be interested in the other person's life. To have a curiosity and an empathy for how they are feeling, rather than thinking, I get home, I want my food, I want to sit down in front of the television, I want my beer or glass of wine. Rather than cultivating the intimacy and the friendship. And I think cultivating, you know, common interests is incredibly important. My wife and I love exercising together, you know, walking, running, Pilates. We love bird watching. We love sailing. Thankfully, we have interests. Now, there are many couples who have difficulty with finding common interests. And many couples for whom one is physically much less able than the other. But working at those common interests, I think, is important. Building love maps, understanding your spouse's story and what attachment means to them. What was their early childhood relationship like with their parents? What was their parents' relationship like? Hopefully, premarital counseling goes into that, and you explore some of that with the couple. And I think part of this is learning the things and the places that you each like. Understanding each other's dreams and hopes and aspirations. And that will change over time at different phases of life. This is the fondness and admiration system is basically saying thank you and often saying I love you and I really love what you're wearing today you look beautiful and thank you so much for that wonderful meal that you cooked or for writing that letter to our kids when I didn't have time or whatever it is. It's this active gratitude, the discipline of gratitude. And we've discovered in positive psychology, as it's called, that that's an incredibly important healing thing in any broken relationship. Taking the time to touch physically and not necessarily, wives often say, whenever he touches me, I know he wants sex. That's a big turnoff. But if they know that you are just touching them, just an arm around their shoulders, a quick hug, a kiss, all of this is the sort of the bonding part of the relationship, which enables you at particular times then to have a good sex life. But there are some people who say you need to hug for at least 3 minutes a day. You need to kiss for at least 10 seconds. A 10-second kiss for once a day, or maybe a few others as well. You need to touch at night. You need to hug. And this is, I think, as we know, the differences between men and women. This is more important for women than men. And as men get older, as I have discovered, they're able to enjoy the cuddles and the affection without the sort of pressure for, let's go on, let's have intercourse together. And so respecting the differences there is incredibly important. Creating shared meaning with rituals, with holidays, with celebrations. The Gottmans really, these are their headings, and I'm filling in some of the detail here. Then in managing conflict constructively, they say that in all marriages there are major areas of disagreement, and that 69% of the time, conflicts come over unresolvable issues. Now, we always have this romantic idea that Christian marriages shouldn't have differences and shouldn't have unresolvable issues. But maybe there are some, and there certainly are in my marriage, things that have always caused tension between us because of our different ways of looking at it. But it's how you manage those that is so critical. Can you agree to disagree rather than forcing the other person? And it's important, the Gottmans say, for men to accept influence from women, because we tend to overpower, maybe by our strength of voice or strength of body or whatever it is. You have to develop, they say, shared humor and affection around these tough issues. To be able to laugh together is incredibly important over conflict and difficult things. Building trust. Are you both trustworthy? And they talk about the fact that when they ask people, do you love your spouse? People usually say, of course I do. Do you trust your spouse? Well, let me think about that for a minute. That's a little more difficult, because there have been, in most marriages, times of betrayal. Whether it's sexual betrayal into pornography or an affair, or whether it's financial betrayal, all sorts of things get in the way. So trust is really important, because we want to know that there is someone there who will catch me if I fall. When I am weak, when I am depressed, time of depression that I went through, I was so glad that my wife was able to care for me and encourage me in that. And when she has been down and struggling with work issues, that she should know that I am there for her. It's a very basic relational task that we learn very early, isn't it? And a lot of the people who come to us with marriage problems have very poor examples and have not been well attached to trustworthy people in their childhood. That makes it much more difficult in your marriage. Now, the final bit here is Sue Johnson with her marriage research, which she's written in a book called Hold Me Tight, and a more recent book called Love Sense. This is emotionally focused therapy. We teach our students at the seminary this because it is fairly, it's complex when it's done really well, but it's fairly simple to teach and to learn. And it has such strong connections with a Christian view. Although she is a humanist, she is a very caring and very sensitive person in human relationships. This is part of what I would call common grace wisdom. The basic focus in her work is we're made for connection and deep attachment. You can't go far wrong with that, can you? I mean, we're made in the image of God for relationship, made for connection and deep attachment. And she goes through various stages, which I'll just mention quickly here, but the first is defining what she calls the demon dialogues or defensive dances. So she calls one the protest polka, where one partner is always demanding and the other person is always withdrawing. Or another one is find the bad guy. So one person is always blaming. Or you're each blaming each other, always making the other person the bad guy. So that once you have built a relationship with the couple, you've heard what their struggles are, then you begin to work with them to define these demon dialogues. Because most couples get into cycles, and they go through the same pattern again and again. You probably see it in your own marriages. And so usually we say to people, after you've been through the initial interviews of getting to know them, next week I want you to come back and I want you to tell me one incident this week where you had conflict. And let's just talk about that one incident. And in that incident, you will find that demon dialogue. And so you help them to see the pattern. Now, you're not blaming one or the other. You're looking for what happens between them. Okay? That's a very important thing. And you're helping them to name the cycle and to recognize and put words to their own and their spouse's emotions. So most couples get into conflict and they're not actually talking about what's under the surface. They're just dealing with the surface issue. What they really need to talk about is what's below the surface. What's the fear? What's the longing under the surface that is not, that the fear that you're trying to avoid, what's making you feel ashamed? So the softer emotions under anger, like guilt and shame, inferiority, fear, pain, memories of traumatic past incidents. So you enable them to say to each other, when my spouse, when my wife or my husband does this, I feel this. When have I felt that before in my life? And here you're taking them back into their attachment history in early life. And how did I react then? I find that I get, when I'm angry, I get afraid and panicky. And then I lash out or I retreat. I get withdrawn when I feel intimidated and incompetent and helpless. That's the stuff below the surface, isn't it? That people don't usually take the time. So you're slowing the whole process down and unwrapping, expanding the emotions. And the therapist does a lot of reflecting back in a sort of Rogerian style, but putting it in other words and amplifying it and almost exaggerating it so that they see it more clearly. Then they would name and revisit what they call the raw spots, what I've called the wounds we often talk about. You know, what are the raw spots in your marriage which keep coming up? That time when your husband went away on a business trip and he didn't call you once during that week when he was away, and you felt deeply hurt and betrayed by him. That time when you went to hospital to have the baby and he was too busy at work and he didn't make the time to get away and come until he arrived an hour after you'd had the baby. You've never talked about it before, but it's there, it's a sense of betrayal. And then helping them to take responsibility and to say, I am so sorry, I never realized how much I hurt you by that action. Behind this, as I mentioned earlier, is putting words to fears and longings. Because all of us have deep fears and anxieties that rule our lives, or tend to, and we also have deep longings. I long for my wife to be able to affirm me more. I long for her respect. I'm afraid that she always notices the things that I do wrong and never notices the things that I do right. You may have never verbalized that. So putting these fears into words and longings in a safe environment so the counselor has to create that trust, that relationship. This isn't something you do over just a few weeks. This may be over 20 weeks. Here we're getting into professional marriage therapy. And then, interestingly, she goes on, has a chapter in her book on forgiveness, which for us, obviously, is an incredibly important part of all relationships, of mutual repentance and forgiveness. And she, just as I would have often taught on this topic, is in that there's a lot of light forgiveness that people, so to actually ask, to be truly repentant and ask forgiveness is to name the damage that you have done, to name the hurt that you have caused, and to say, please will you forgive me? I know that this was the effect of what I did. Most of us just say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to hurt you. You're making an excuse. You're running away from really deep repentance and forgiveness. Learning to delight in and to forgive your spouse. We've talked about that earlier, I think, what it means to delight in. So that marriage finally becomes a secure base, this is her language, and a safe haven for both of you. A secure base and a safe haven for you both to go out into the world. No longer are you facing each other with swords drawn against each other like enemies, now you are, in Dan Allender's words, intimate allies. You are standing back to back and side by side with your swords drawn towards the world and the flesh and the devil. So I think there is a danger, as I finish here, of idolatry of marriage, in the sense that if my marriage is fine, let me put it another way. If I expect all my needs in my life for love and affection and affirmation and satisfaction to be met in my marriage, you will be bitterly disappointed. If you are a perfectionist who expects your spouse to be perfect, you will, as Mrs. Schaefer used to say, if you expect perfection, you'll end up with nothing. You will destroy your marriage. And I think that the calling here, and this passage from Ecclesiastes 4:12, which is often used in marriage sermons as well, which actually I think is somewhat taking it out of real context, but I'm going to use it anyway. It's about the nature of we need support from other people around us. And two people are not enough. You need a third. And we use it in the sense that a marriage is in danger if you don't have Christ in that relationship too. A three-stranded cord is not easily broken. A two-stranded cord comes unraveled very quickly. So obviously for us as Christians, our relationship with the Lord is just foundational in this. And a couple needs to be cultivating that together in their prayer life, to have times to pray together, to reflect on Scripture together. That's always difficult when you have young children, and we weren't very good at it at that time. When your children have left home, it's a whole lot easier to have that sort of discipline. But so these are some of the things, some ideas, hopefully some catalysts to your own thinking, some books to read on this topic. Reflections, thoughts. Yeah.
Could you speak to the idealization of marriage? What are our legitimate expectations?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great question about the historically the change, and I'll repeat your question in a sense in my answer here. The change of expectations on marriage. I mean, people stuck together for economic reasons, for social reasons. There was a huge cultural expectation that people would stay together, huge shame in divorce. So you'd stay together through thick and thin, and for some people that worked and they had love in that too. For others, it was just a social arrangement. Now the pressure is, I think, on you've got to feel really attached and good about your marriage. And there are good things about both. I think we need a scaffolding of social expectations that help us to push against our fallenness and our brokenness, don't we? We need laws that make breaking up of marriage difficult. That helps. But the old view perhaps was very thin on the need for deep communication and real affection. I mean, I think that's a little reflection on that one. Other thoughts? Are you familiar with Gottman and Johnson and these people? No? Sue Johnson's book is a secular book, and Gottman is also. Gottman is Jewish, by the way. He's a wonderful guy, a delightful man, probably about the same age as me, a fun speaker to listen to. You can get probably on YouTube, you can see him in action. But he's a really careful researcher. Over 30 years he's been doing this research. It says it's a volatile, avoiding and validating styles he identified in marriage. Yeah. And what the Gottmans found was that, and this is where I said it's how you do the conflict that really matters. And there are couples who do have pretty volatile conflict. And they do. Some of them seem to survive. I would imagine, though, that, and I'd like to find out a bit more about what he does with them. Whether he is also helping them to move towards some of the good skills. He's talking about the masters who have all these qualities. A volatile couple doesn't have many of those. The validating couple would. But he's saying, as you said, that when you put a volatile couple and an avoidant couple together, then you have to work at learning how to speak the other's language, or perhaps each of you needs to learn a new language of conflict, which is a more biblical, Christian, healthy view. This is related to the leaving and cleaving bit, that if you come from one person comes from a very volatile family, the other from a very avoidant family. It's interesting, with my wife and I came from a family where I saw very little conflict. And I realized that I don't like conflict at all, because I didn't really know how to deal with it. That's got me into some trouble in life. My wife came from a family where her parents would have pretty loud fights, and she hated conflict because of that. So here we were together with two different styles, and for a long time we didn't understand what was going on until we began to see the connections. And then we began to learn how to respect the differences and help each other to navigate this. Yeah.
How would you define volatile? Because, and they're just like that, they're right in your face, and they speak with their hands, and when we first observed them talking to each other, we thought that they were fighting. Oh my goodness, they need help. But no, they were just being very honest and very expressive in That's their honesty.
This is great. This is explaining, I think, what the Gottmans are saying exactly. There's cultural difference, and I see the same between African Americans in the American culture and white Caucasian folk. African Americans are very loud and expressive and hands everywhere, and I get scared when they're around like that. But that's just the way that they're being honest. And so a couple who do that with each other, they know each other's language. Okay. They don't interpret it as attack. Mm-hmm. It's just, this is their normal style of communication. So that's a very helpful comment.
Tim. Volatile is they don't beat around the bush. It's out in the open. You say it how it is. Thick-skinned type of people. The avoidant are just the opposite. It'll be indirect communication, very passive.
That's right. That's great. Thank you. I think we have, two more. Can we take two more brief questions? I'm going to break the rules here.
I would think, and would you agree, that the best protection against thinking about my marriage as this ideal and making idol out of it is to understand well that my primary role of my marriage is to glorify God, act out relationship of Christ and Church, of God the Father and God the Son, in a missional way.
That's a wonderful comment to come near the end with, I think, of that our marriages should be glorifying God, and that's in a sense our goal. And I do think, we need within the church, in an age where marriages are disintegrating all around us, it is a very wonderful testimony and witness to I often think that marriages and funerals are wonderful places to witness to God and to the reality of his existence. And sometimes having inviting your friends to celebrate your 25th anniversary or your 42nd anniversary or whatever. When I tell people I've been married 42 years, they say, "What? That long? That's amazing." It does, and it takes away the focus from us if we see this as a mission, having a missional purpose as part of it, for sure. Yeah, last one.
Really quickly, as quickly as you can, those of us who are not professionals, troubled marriages in a church, troubled marriages, what do we do?
Gosh, that's a great, great question. I wish you'd asked it earlier. You asked the question before of when do you stop helping. I mean, we almost need a whole nother session, don't we? I mean, I think when people come to pastors, ideally pastors have a network, or certainly in the States we have, or in St. Louis, a network of counselors they can refer to. But I think as a pastor, you can work with people on some basic principles of conflict management. Some of these things that I've talked about, that's partly why I talked about these, because they are fairly simple. I mean, I think asking a couple to read Gottman's book together about his findings about marriage is a helpful thing. There are good books, good Christian books on marriage, which you can give to people. But I think for most parties, they haven't got the time to go beyond 4 or 5 sessions with a couple. And if they feel the need to do that, then they need to refer to someone else if possible.
And if we would take 4 or 5 couples together in a group.
And that's another thing, yeah.
Does that work or is that...
Some folk do that. Now, again, I mean, ideally, you're working in your church to do a lot of preventative work. Mm-hmm. So that's the time, I think, when to get couples together before they've actually come to you in big problems, that you put them, you have a marriage seminar or you have a marriage weekend retreat where you're strengthening the marriages. And then some of the ones that need help will probably come out of the woodwork.
Okay.
And the ones who need the more special help. But there's a lot you can do in just marriage retreats, training. The network, I think, on marriage and family is primarily aimed at that sort of thing here. When do you stop? Obviously there are some marriages where people are heading for divorce. By the time they get to me, they've usually been through 2 or 3 other counselors and they're sent to me because I have some experience, and what they really want is me to give them permission to get divorced. And at times, you know, there are folk who you try to work with, and you may come to the conclusion that really they have lost all respect for each other. And here you get into obviously the biblical grounds for divorce. I think there is a place for separation. Separation is always dangerous because often people get used to that and may go on to divorce. And I always see separation as temporary in situations of crisis. But if there has been, when someone has committed adultery, when someone's been involved, a spouse is heavily involved with pornography or other addictions, there is a breaking of the covenant, which I think allows divorce. It's not something you immediately go to, but ideally you do that in the context of the eldership of the church they're involved in, and they take responsibility for pastoring and shepherding them through the process of a dissolution of a marriage. But you know, if someone has been unfaithful and shows no repentance, then certainly there are grounds for divorce. If someone is being abused physically, emotionally, and it just goes on and there is no change, then I would encourage them to leave. And that may well go to divorce. So there are times when it's right to say, you should not continue in this marriage. We need to finish, folks. Thank you again for your attention, and thank you.